The year is 2020. It has brought us a global pandemic, riots in the streets of America, and a presidential impeachment trial that turned the United States upside down.
Against Donald John Trump, President of the United States.
But in between those world-changing events, the UFO phenomena has increasingly been given more credibility and more serious exposure on the nightly news programs.
I know you think it's important. I know you think that the government didn't take the threat seriously enough. So let me just ask you point blank the question. Do you believe that life from somewhere else came here, visited, and observed?
My guest today is Stephen Bassett. For nearly 25 years, he has aimed to end what he calls a government-imposed truth embargo behind extraterrestrial-related phenomena. He organized the citizen hearing on disclosure at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C.
Good morning to the committee. I'm Stephen Bassett, Executive Director of Paradigm Research Group and an activist.
And he spearheaded political initiatives that injected the ET issue into the 2016 presidential campaign. Pending lawsuits and controversy aside, a new presidential administration is about to take over. How, if at all, will that change the landscape for the UFO issue that has seemingly picked up steam in the past couple of years? Stay tuned. You're about to journey inside the Black Vault. That's right, everybody. This is the Black Vault Radio. I'm your host, John Greenwald Jr. As always, thank you so much for stepping into the vault and taking this journey with me. Now, I'm excited about today's show. I don't want to waste any time here in the beginning because I want to welcome my guest, Mr. Stephen Bassett. Now, Stephen, you definitely take the cake for having pretty much the best background that I have had on this show thus far. Very, very cool setup you got there. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, you're only as good as your production qualities these days, my friend.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, there's an account on Twitter that actually rates the background, the Zoom backgrounds of all the newscasters. It's actually pretty funny if you haven't seen it. So, Steve, I have a lot of respect for your work and what you have achieved here in the last, you've been around the field pretty much as long as I have, going on about 24, 25 years now. And I have a lot of respect because you are very much a boots on the ground type of guy. I've heard you say you may change this answer. I've heard you say you're not a researcher, but rather you're an activist. You're out there pushing to get change. I've had you on the show before, but give everybody a refresher. What is the nutshell version of what you are trying to accomplish?
Oh, I'm a political activist, and Paradigm Research Group was set up to be a political activist organization, though the name is Paradigm Research Group. So yeah, right away, I'm confusing people. But the reason that has that name is that the first thing I did to begin my career in this field was to register as a lobbyist, because nobody had ever done that on the ET issue, which I knew would get attention. And it did, and it got me media coverage, Washington Post, things like that. And that's how I got going. Didn't know much. I hoped to learn, right? So because I registered for a number of organizations, free, pro bono, just let me register for you, a number of different groups, organizations, which were research organizations, basically. And so I called it Paradigm Research Group. But it's a political activist operation. And the goal was simple, to resolve the extraterrestrial issue by political means. Now, not surprisingly, when I entered the field in 1996, I had already concluded beyond any reasonable doubt that I have that the phenomena that we've been paying so much attention to is extraterrestrial in origin. It wasn't up for debate with me. If it was, it would be kind of hard to be an activist. So I start from that position, and I've never changed my view on that. I'm highly confident that it's correct. So the issue then was, why are we still talking about this? Why is it still in question? Why are we still talking about UFOs? What is the matter here? And I concluded it was a political problem, not a science problem. There'd been plenty of science done to the best the ability and resources of the citizen science movement operating against the government's truth embargo. It was a political problem. A political decision was made that this incredible truth, fundamental truth, not getting into all the details, of the fact that we are being engaged now by entities from other places, almost certainly other planets, was not a good idea given the circumstances at the time, 47 and forward. And so they embargoed it. And then they had to maintain that truth embargo, and it wasn't easy. It required them to do a lot of things, which I'm sure some of which are not proud of. And that embargo was still going on in 96. And my work was to try to end it, to end the truth embargo. And to end the truth embargo is to get the acknowledgement of the ET presence by the head of state, mm-hmm. not by some scientist, not by a movie star, but by the president of this country or another. And that would be called disclosure. That's come to be called, and I helped to make that the nomenclature, disclosure with a capital D. It's the announcement. It's the confirmation. Disclosure with a small D is the process of revealing information. That's been going on, still going on. So you've got a small D disclosure process seeking the end of the truth embargo by a capital D disclosure event. That's what I do. That's what I've done as best I could with the resources that I've had.
Before we get into the current state of where we are at and how the last couple of years have gone, because it's been very exciting in this field, I want to ask you one slightly personal question on taking you back to when you first registered to be a lobbyist on this issue. You said that you were convinced. What was it that convinced you? Was it a specific case? Did you have an experience? What locked you into saying, this is real, this is extraterrestrial in nature, and the government's covering this up?
Going all the way back to my teenage years in the 60s, as you know, there was media coverage of this phenomenon. In fact, there's been a lot of media coverage of this phenomenon. I estimate 30,000 articles have been written in mainstream media about the ET phenomenon or the UAP phenomenon. I've got 11,000 of those articles linked on my website right now. But, you know, most of that was available through the internet. So there's thousands and thousands of articles that you can only archive or log in by going to libraries, literally in microfiche. I don't have the time for that, but there's thousands of those. So I'm seeing these articles. Now, I wasn't a stupid kid. And I'm reading this and I'm going, well, that seems to point to extraterrestrials. That points to extraterrestrials and so forth. And going, okay. And, two things were happening. One, I was starting to get a sense of the evidence that's coming forward, which is totally appropriate, and also quite surprised that the government wasn't responding to this evidence. It was literally being reported in major papers. There's a disconnect here. But I figured, hey, eventually they'll get around to it. There was a war in Vietnam that looked like it was going to go on forever, and they were pretty wrapped up in that. I was generous, and I had my own problems. So as the years go by, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, I'm paying attention to the evidence that's turning up. Well, hey, based on just what was in the news and what was being produced by researchers, citizen researchers, it was conclusive. It had to be extraterrestrial. It's not about smoking guns. That's not the way things are decided in science or in criminal law. You listen to an extensive trial, many witnesses, many evidence, and the collective evidence convinces the person is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. I can say with high confidence, and by 96, the amount of evidence that I saw in various ways was convincing beyond a reasonable doubt as of then. And as I go back in time now, later on, as I went back in time, to even to the 40s and 50s, I believe the evidence was beyond a reasonable doubt then. All right. And so the truth embargo, to give you a sense of how significant it is, its job was to convince the American people, the journalists, the academics, and so forth, that whatever was turning up, whether it was 47, 52, anything that was turning up, anything was being uncovered by researchers like MUFON or NICAP or anything being reported in the news about sightings and so forth, none of it was significant evidence for an extraterrestrial presence. And the government really went to great lengths to do that. I call it the truth embargo. It was well serviced and it was successful.
Why do you think that is?
It's not something we want to ever do again.
Because I agree with you. I'm on board with that. They have been adamant about denying this and essentially concealing the truth for decades. I believe it's still going on. In your opinion, with what you've seen and who you've talked to, why?
I'm asked that question all the time. The government has not obviously told us why, because the government says there's no extraterrestrial. So why would they tell us why? They not covered up, but embargoed the truth of that. So it's kind of a catch 22. But I think the evidence is pretty clear. Whatever had happened prior to 1947, say, Foo Fighters, maybe a crash or two in the 30s, I don't know. But and then the Ancient Aliens. But Ancient Aliens hadn't come on History Channel yet. There was no History Channel. So anything that happened prior to that, it was in 47 when this thing it absolutely exploded worldwide. And the most notable thing that happened early on in 47 was the Roswell. And by the way, a lot of people, I think, are confused about the Roswell event. The crash at Roswell occurred before the Arnold sightings at Mount Rainier, not after, right? That's something that people, I think, mistake. And if you want to learn about that, just go read the front page of the Roswell Daily Record from July 8, 1947. So the government knows right then that they have an extraterrestrial presence. They have the craft, they have bodies, and I believe they had a live body, at least that's what the report was. Don't know how long it lived. And that's pretty conclusive, isn't it? They absolutely know that. And there's no doubt, there's no question. They weren't genetically modified Chinese people. They were extraterrestrial. Okay, so they know that. Now it's 47. They know at 47 that the Russians have got the nuclear weapon secrets, atomic and nuclear, and they're probably going to test their technology, which they did in 49 and 53. So they know that's coming. There's an iron curtain over Europe. We have generals in our military saying we need to attack the Soviets now. We can't wait until they get any stronger. And so they are confronting what they believe will be the basis for the next war, World War III, which of course we were going to have World War III because that's what we do. We have wars. 10,000 years of wars, and we had two buttes, and we could probably have an even bigger one if we wanted to. More importantly, I think any reasonable person in the military intelligence complex at the time would have concluded that the next war will be with nukes. And so they are facing the prospect of a nuclear World War III in 1947. At minimum, they're facing the implications of a massive confrontation between the East and the West that it was already developing. And they know about extraterrestrials. And so the idea was, no, we can't. We don't know what these ETs are up to. We don't know much about the tech yet. We don't know much of anything. So we can't just go to the public and say there's ETs here. We don't know why they're here. We don't know what the tech is. No. And so this became classified. It also because of the potential weaponology that could come from the crash vehicle. So we'll classify it. Absolutely secret until we know more. Now, I think within the MIC at the time, they probably thought, well, look, at some point, particularly if the situation with the Soviet Union gets resolved and we get some stability there and maybe we're not in such a dangerous situation, see how this nuclear thing goes, we'll tell the public. But what they didn't know and couldn't have known in 47 was we weren't going to have a nuclear World War III. Thank God. Almost had it several times. What they didn't know was we were going to have a Cold War. They didn't even have the term for it at the time. Cold War, what's that? It is a war that doesn't involve actually launching weapons at each other. It's an endless threat of launching weapons. A Cold War, a nuclear standoff, which they eventually called Mutual Assured Destruction, probably the most profound, MAD, the most profound acronym ever for anything. And so as the years go by, from 47 to 91, 44 years, what they are seeing is the development of the nuclear arms race and the amassment of nuclear weapons and nuclear weapons delivery systems. underwater, above ground, in the air, and ultimately 80-some thousand nuclear weapons were stockpiled by eight countries by the mid-80s. And so as you think about through those 44 years, who in the government was going to raise their hand and say, you know, nuclear war could happen tomorrow. There's weapons everywhere. We may have 20 seconds of notice off the nuke submarines, but let's tell the public about the extraterrestrials. Let's throw that in the mix. No, they were not going to get consensus on that, and they didn't. And I don't blame them. I wouldn't argue with it. So that explains the first 44 years, John.
Yeah.
Then you have a different set of explanations after that from 91 forward.
And that's what I'm curious about, because I know I've got a little bit of limited time with you. And I want to talk a little bit about present day, because it seems like things are shifting. And by present day, I mean in the last, you know, let's say three plus years.
Absolutely.
And I get the hesitation through the 40s and the 50s and the Cold War and so on and so forth. Right. Let's bring it to today. Do you feel that society at this point, Cold War's over? Yeah, we've got some tension with some key nuclear players out there, and that's worrisome. But the likelihood of a nuclear war at this point is fairly nil. I mean, even at the height of the North Korea crisis, mm-hmm. that's a different show, I'm guessing, by the look on your face. But
I think
what's that?
No, let me mention, John. Look, the bulletin of nuclear. The bulletin of atomic scientist just set the doomsday clock 100 seconds to midnight. It's the closest it's ever been, and I agree with it. Mm-hmm. We are more at risk of nuclear war than we have been before, amazingly enough, for different reasons. So that hasn't changed.
So then do you feel that tension still plays a role in today, or do you think capital D disclosure is unfolding as you and I are chatting right now?
Great. Yes. At the end of the Cold War, 1991, that was a major change. That was most significant development at that point on the truth embargo. And so the door opened for disclosure to take place, because technically Cold War is over. Sorry, I'm not speaking as well as I used to, John, but I've been in isolation.
No, that's okay, though. I'm following you.
Right? So the Cold War is over. And so the door opened. But at the exact time that door opened for to really reconsider whether to tell the people the truth, we were in the middle of a war in Kuwait, as you know, which also got into Iraq to some degree. And it was pretty tense. Mm-hmm. It tied up the Bush administration. And ultimately, you know, he lost the election. So a new president comes in who's not George H.W. Bush. And right then, it wasn't ideal for the military intelligence complex. They didn't like that. And so that was one of many reasons why the truth embargo was able to continue from 91 all the way to the present, 29 years. But other reasons developed. And so the history of the truth embargo, I think, from 91 forward is much more complex than it is from 44 to 91. There are reasons, and it kind of made progress, and then it would come back, and it would go forward and come back. And the best way I can sum it up in a few words, because this will be huge, books will be written about this, is that after the Cold War ends, the U.S. government is faced with a reasonable prospect that they could disclose, but they had a massive public relations problem, meaning we have embargoed this for 44 years. We have lied to our teeth. We have inhibited. We have undermined. We've classified everything. We have violated the Constitution by not briefing all the presidents fully for political reasons, and on and on. And so they're facing a massive public relations problem. And I think that what was going on in these 30 years is how to solve that. Mm-hmm. How can we do this and look good? How can we minimize the blowback? Lawsuits and tear whatever. How can we be seen as the good guys? I mean, that is incredibly simplistic. But in fact, when you examine the history of the last 30 years, you keep seeing indications of this. Consider it a public relations problem. And so in a sense, the activist movement had one of its many goals, and there were a number, techniques, was to try to help solve the public relations problem of the U.S. government, the military intelligence complex. That was one. The other was language. We had to clarify the language, which I helped to work on that. You had to educate the journalists to the exopolitical stuff, not just saucers, mm-hmm. And the public and so forth. But the public relations problem was the issue.
And you still feel that they still have that PR problem.
No, they're gonna have a PR problem right up to the end. But and then let me move on, because I know where you want to go with this. One of the chief things that we're trying to achieve, not simply me, but NICAP and James McDonald and MUFON and Hynek and all of them and all the researchers that you know well, many of which are actually your colleagues, and the activists. One of the fundamental things we were trying to do was to raise the level of understanding of the issue, increase the amount of evidence, of course, educate the public to the point where a significant element within the military intelligence complex itself, some of which may have felt, you know, the truth needed to come out decades ago, would get to the point where they were not only willing to support the military intelligence complex advancing this issue of disclosure, but are willing to participate in it. And while there were some fits and starts over the years, odd person would turn up, an astronaut here, an astronaut there, we weren't able to get to the point where an organized effort from within the military intelligence complex would come forward until October 11th, 2017, the launch of the To the Stars Academy, which was, I think, in the planning stages, going all the way back to late 2015. So a lot of time and effort went into it, a lot of thought. It was a sophisticated, well thought through project, which I believe was supposed to be launched in late November, December 2016. Ultimately, did not get launched until October 2017. So. I say that with a certain humility. I believe that the To the Stars Academy is not going to do what it did in 2017 without the decades of work of unsung people with very little resources, fighting against ridicule and demeanment, with very little money and suffering greatly in many cases. All those decades made it possible for them to step forward, but not surprisingly. And I respect this. Mm-hmm. When they did step forward with the plan that they had to approach it as if it was starting from scratch. In other words, we're gonna get this issue resolved. We're here. Here's what's going on. And they couldn't get into all of the decades of work prior to them. So they were sort of acting like, hey, you probably don't know this. We're going to tell you now. Here's what's going on. And we're starting from scratch here. And there was a reason for that, and I understand it. But I think it's important to remind people from time to time, and hopefully even the journalist, that there were 70 years of incredible effort by a citizen science research community leading up to the day they announced the To the Stars Academy.
Do you feel that this To the Stars Academy and what they did, which I've complimented them on this show before, I know that I get a lot of heat for bringing up what I call red flags in the story.
Right.
But regardless, I have always given them credit for bringing this issue to the forefront. Just right. So I'm clear, do you feel that that was a government-sanctioned effort, or do you believe that there were just government personnel that came out and sanctioned, hey, we need to get this out of the open? Mr. Christopher Mellon just admitted on James Fox's documentary, I'm paraphrasing here, but essentially, I believe his words were, you know, twisting the rules or bending the rules a little bit to get this out. Who orchestrated that movement and that push that ultimately right. happened at the end of 2017?
Look, we don't know the full origin story, and they're not telling us the origin story. They hint a little bit, they mention something here, but in terms of, we're not going to get that. Because the origin story begins literally within the military intelligence complex, mostly in the Pentagon, but CIA people were involved and others working in different agencies and so forth, all with security clearances, all full careers. That's the TTS team, and and you know who they are, and your viewers can go to their website and read their resume. I'm absolutely convinced there is no way that this ever happens without support from within the MIC. We don't know how broad it is. We don't know how far up the chain of command it goes, but it's simply not possible. There's just no way. These people have all kinds of non-disclosure agreements, and they have security clearances, and they're going to come out and do this. And the Department of Defense is going, well, we can't stop them. Hey, it's a free country. And no, absolutely not. So that's point one. Point two, we also know that Herman Kahn, the CIA careerist, mm-hmm. who's part of the TTA, actually stated to one of our colleagues that there are 30 or 40 people within the Department of Defense who are, how would you say, backing them up, mm-hmm. right? So, yes, it is informally sanctioned. It has to be informally sanctioned, which gets us to a key point. What's going on here is extraordinarily complicated. This is not easy. You have to admire the courage to even attempt it, mm-hmm. right? So what has happened, as far as I can tell, is that enough support within the Department of Defense developed, at what level we're not sure, to provide cover for these people to go and do what they do. I assume there is also plenty of elements within the MIC that don't want this. They didn't want it, but however strong the detractors are, the people backing them up are apparently powerful enough that they're covered. Mm-hmm. As you know, in the 3 years, they have not been attacked by any of the agencies or by the military services. There has been no orchestrated effort from within the government to in any way undermine what they're doing.
You're talking about TTSA?
Yes.
Because respectfully disagree simply because the Pentagon has... And this leads into my next question. So if you don't mind if I just jump in here. Sure. The Pentagon obviously has muddied the water considerably.
Correct.
With statements about Mr. Luis Elizondo specifically, which in my opinion is unprecedented. They normally leave names out of it. Snowden, I could think, is really the only more modern example of them taking shots through press statements against a specific American either contractor or serviceman. So for them to go on the record and say this, for me, was a little bit, you know, unprecedented in the fact that they did that. So let me ask you that.
Yeah, I don't see it that way. Look.
But you have to admit that was a shot to essentially undermine that effort.
Let's get context to this. Mm-hmm. By the way, as far as Snowden is concerned, we've had people in the Congress call for his execution. So it's a little stronger response to Edward Snowden. Again, remember I said this is an incredibly complex thing that happened.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So one of the problems that they faced was that they were not going to be able to, and I'm sure did not, send out emails to all of the military services, intelligence agencies, and all the PR or public relations departments of all these entities saying, hey, in X number of months, we're going to launch this organization and it's going to be addressing ET issue. We're going to raise money. And there's a whole bunch of high level people that mm-hmm. worked in government going to be. No, they didn't tell anybody. This thing came out absolutely cold. Well, let me put this way. Tom DeLong was hinting about it. And it was okay for him to do that. Mm-hmm. So he was hinting about it, and there was stuff going on a little bit behind the scenes that eventually got outed in the WikiLeaks release. But overall, this was all clandestine, it was all behind the scenes, except for some things that Tom said, but didn't get in any specifics. And so so they launched, the rest of the government didn't know. The Pentagon office didn't know. The Navy didn't know. The Air Force didn't know. And so they're all caught, whatever. All right, so that's the way they had to do it. If they had notified all these entities in advance, they would have had so much pushback, they would have never gotten out the door. And so they come out the door, and then naturally, people such as yourself and others, they're going to start looking into this. Mm-hmm. What's going on here? Call up the Air Force. Call up the Navy. Call up the Defense Department. What do you know about this? Well, the Defense Department didn't know about this. And so what happened is the spokespeople for the Pentagon made a number of statements that was based on what they had mm-hmm. that were ultimately wrong. And they were probably not happy either. Okay. And so that created some confusion, and it's understandable. And it's one of the difficulties they had to face. They were going to have to deal with the confusion that was going to emanate from various parts of the government when they suddenly turned up, and knowing that a lot of journalists are going to be then going to these entities, what the hell is going on here? And that, and they basically handled that pretty well, not too bad. And as far as the fact that the Pentagon spokespeople may have said something critical of Elizondo or got something wrong, that's not the blowback I'm talking about. I'm talking about these gentlemen getting contacts from the Department of Defense, basically saying, you will stop this or we will do things which we'll find very unpleasant. And I assure you, every one of them is vulnerable to all of that. That did not happen. I'm almost positive it didn't happen. So again, that tells me that that gives me a sense of it. Now, let me restate it a little bit. Remember my public relations theme. And I've stated this before, and I'll continue to do so. If the TTSA corrects me, if they get in touch with me and say, Mr. Bassett, you've got it wrong. This is not the way it was. This is not what's going on. And I'll listen. And I may very well come forward and say, wait a minute, I think I've rethought this. The TTSA is not a scientific organization being created to go and solve the extraterrestrial question. It's not going to create warp drive. It's going to look into these things, and those are things that may want to engage. Fine. They need to present something like that. But what is it fundamentally? The TTSA is a surrogate entity created to push the disclosure process forward in service to interest entities within the military intelligence complex that are convinced the truth embargo's days need to end, that this thing has got to stop. It's becoming an embarrassment and a problem and is enormously more difficult every year to maintain. But they can't do it directly. The Department of Defense, guys in the Department of Defense just can't start calling up the New York Times and saying, hey, look, I got some gun camera footage here. You want to see it? They can't be speaking out. They serve the president. The president is their commander in chief. Technically, anything of that magnitude can't happen unless the president authorizes it. And so they have been contained. This is just to say, from day one, 47 on, anyone in the government, in the military intelligence complex, who are sympathetic to getting this truth out have been contained legally and whatever. Okay, so what do they do? They came up with a brilliant idea. We'll create a surrogate entity made up of former members of the military intelligence complex, which will be very open about all of their ties and the work they did by and large and their clearances and so forth. Clearly one of us, but not working for us anymore. And so they will then take the story to the New York Times. So that gun camera footage goes from a vault in the Department of Defense, either to Elizondo directly, to Mellon directly, supposedly he got it in a parking lot, or to Elizondo and then to Mellon, whatever, and then it was taken to the New York Times. And everything that's happened since then, they are basically speaking for those elements in the military intelligence complex, whether it's the CIA or the Department of Defense, that this embargo needs to end. And they've been pursuing that in a very orderly fashion, which, by and large, is being done in a way that's clearly in concert, I think, with what the Department of Defense would want if they were doing it. In other words, national security issues, potential threat issues, set up congressional hearings, develop military witnesses, bring them in to testify. After enough testimony has taken place, then the door is open for the president to announce. This is the proper way to do it. I certainly have always supported that way. But nobody in the field, not me, not Greer, not anybody, has been remotely in a position to be able to do what these gentlemen have done, because we don't have the connections, the gravitas, and the imprimatur provided by people within government. We are outsiders trying to force the government to do what it doesn't want to do. Now we're in a situation where we're trying to help the government do what it wants to do, which is why over the last 3 years, you probably noticed, I haven't done much. I made a decision to stay out of their way. In other words, I'm going to let the TTSA do what it needs to do. I'll follow it closely. I'll comment on it from time to time. but I'm not going to try to, you know, get out there and in front of them and whatever. No, no, they are the point of the spear. They're going to make this happen. They are going to cross the TTSA is taking the football across the end zone into the end zone. They're going to spike the ball and they're going to get the Super Bowl trophy. And good on them, because if that's what it takes, by God, that's what we have to do.
There's a couple questions on that theme that I want to ask you, but I want to start here. Now, for the record, I personally don't believe in this aspect of the theory with their government connection. So I just want to put that out to you just in case you may have not heard me talk about this. But it is a prevalent theory out there by those that are weary about TTSA and those that are involved. It seems like you're halfway there, that they are kind of sanctioned by the government, that this is being orchestrated by the powers that be, wherever those powers lie. But another part of this is that they are out there working on behalf of the government to misinform the masses. Now, again, I don't buy into that theory, but that is a very prevalent one and one that I'm asked about a lot on, do I believe that this is a misinformation campaign, that they're out there muddying the waters or throwing mud out there. I want you to have the opportunity to address that, because that has gained traction in the last 2 to 3 years when you put that many former government, CIA, all these people together in a team. You are now putting, not you, but the general public is putting all their trust into those men, in this case, all men, that worked for the agencies that have been responsible and have had a hand in the truth embargo, and yet now they're retired, so they're trustworthy. Can you respond to that concept and idea?
If we've learned anything in the last 20 years, let's go back to 95, thanks to the internet and all that came from it, is that there is no end to the list of things that can gain traction on the internet. All right. That's just the way it is. All right. So gaining traction on the internet doesn't carry all that much potency for me. What really matters is what people are doing, not what people think they're doing. And so the TTSA has put out an enormous amount of material, not as much as they wanted to, because they had to slow the things down. But they have websites, they publish stuff, they have, there's thousands of articles written about them, they've given interviews, they finally went on Twitter. Mellon waited a long time, but he entered Twitter on April 20 this year. He's putting out plenty of posts, so is Elizondo. There have been plenty of articles and so forth. Huge amount. I've reviewed a good deal of it. I'm going to review a hell of a lot more of the next few weeks, because I intend to become, to the extent I can, the world's leading expert on the TTSA. And so based upon all of that, I see no indication. Well, it's not a misinformation campaign. No. They are trying to get to the truth. Yes. They're operating in goodwill. Yes. But, and this is where it gets tricky. Remember I said that this is an extraordinarily complicated thing they are doing, which history will certainly acknowledge. I mean, books will be written about it, big, thick books, and I'm going to go, wow. Okay, so you're going to be the surrogate group working outside of the MIC and able to move the issue forward, but the MIC is technically not involved, okay? So it's protected, public relations. But you've got non-disclosure agreements. You have, obviously, security clearances, all of which have certain restrictions that they place on you, all right? And you have and need the support of elements within the MIC to ensure that you can continue forward and not be blocked. And so they're operating from day one under very significant restrictions. There are so many things they can't say. They cannot tell us about classified information. And in many cases, they can't even say that the information exists. In other words, you know, with a special access program, you can say, hey, what about this program? And somebody will say, look, I cannot, it's special access, I cannot discuss it. But if it's an unacknowledged special access program and you ask something related to it, the response has to be, I don't know what you're talking about. And so in some cases, they can't even acknowledge that the question is referring to anything. That is by law. Now, they could break these laws. They could violate these constraints, but that would probably not be a good thing. And so Elizondo and Mellon particularly, these are the two key spokespeople, without question. Elizondo particularly with the tech and witnesses, and Mellon, of course, in the politics. And if you read and listen to what they say, you can just see all of the ways they're having to be careful. And so because they can't be fully forthright, and there's only so many times they can say over and over again, you know, I can't speak to that, I can't speak to that. People are going to go, hey, wait a minute. If you're in the disclosure world now and you're trying to get us the truth, then tell us the truth. I get that. We've been waiting a long time. But most people don't realize that they are having to do this in order to achieve what we want, which is disclosure, which means hearings and ultimately the confirmation. That's what they're trying to achieve. And they have to do it within the constraints that they have, not on the basis of what we want. And so I'm comfortable with how they're proceeding. I understand the limitations they're under. I have not seen a single instance of what I would call deliberate misinformation. I have seen the need to withhold, deflect, and talk around a little bit. They've made a couple of mistakes. That Italian junket they did for the last episode of the first season of Identify was a disaster.
Yeah.
Hey, but you're going to make mistakes. I get that. And at times they have shifted too much into the threat scenario or the threat basis for advancing this issue as opposed to potential threat. And I mentioned that. I understand that they would kind of gravitate there, but then they would kind of come back. Mellon has said a number of things which have mitigated that. Mm-hmm. But in the early days, I understand the threat had to be a little more emphasized. Why? Because it, at the core of their agenda, of their plan, which is to get hearings and ultimately disclosure, is what is the basis on which the committee chairs in Congress and the top journalists are going to listen to us? It's not going to be simply because, hey, I was a big shot in the Pentagon or the CIA, right? It's got to be more than that. And the fundamental basis is clear. It's a national security matter. Nobody disagrees that the extraterrestrial presence is in a national security matter. It's obvious. The nuclear weapons tampering alone locks it in. Mm-hmm. And it's extraordinary that we've never had hearings on that. And that evidence has been out there for a long time, the efforts of Salas and Hastings and so forth. But no hearings on that because, again, truth embargo. But the national security threat is, and why is this important? Because the ETs are, in fact, a national security threat? I don't think they are. But nevertheless, why is it important? Because public relations. If you're a journalist and you're going to cover something, you need to have a basis that is acceptable. If you're a committee chair and you're actually going to call hearings on this, it's got to be a basis which is going to be comfortable and not create problems for you. And so don't expect a committee chair to suddenly come out and say, we need to have a hearing on how we're going to receive the extraterrestrials when they finally arrive and what gifts we will present them when we meet them. No, it's going to be national security. We should talk about this. And of course, that's how they're pursuing it. And that's fine. All right. And I assure you, when these hearings start, which I believe will be in March of next year, national security will be the total package, and there will be almost nothing but military witnesses. And then at some point, it will move past that, and maybe with disclosure, without disclosure. So again, that's the context. I see this. That's the very long answer to your question. Mm-hmm. But can I prove it? No, I can't prove that everything they've said is not misinformation. I can only discuss and relate to what I have seen. But it's a lot. And I'm very comfortable with their approach, their agenda, what they've said, what they've done. I think these people are heroes. I think they're going to go down in history as some of the most important people that ever walked the face of the earth, as far as I'm concerned, because they are the people and the organization which will get the hearings and get disclosure. And I'll be in the audience clapping
the front row
and going, hey, you know, remember me.
Yeah. For years I was there. In the last couple of minutes or so, cause I don't want to run out of time without asking you about this. In the very top of the show, in my introduction for you, I had said lawsuits and controversy aside, we are bringing in a new presidential administration,
right.
Which would be Joe Biden here in the beginning of next year. How does that play a role with this process? Or do you believe this transcends the office of the presidency, which is kind of a theory I've put forward on this channel, that I don't believe a president is read in. I don't believe it. It's a 4 to 8 year office. They like to tweet. The outgoing president has proved that. They're loudmouth. There's a lot of controversy on whether or not certain classified information in the past, including President Trump, has been spilled. Do you believe that a president coming in is going to breathe fresh air to this movement? Or do you think this is beyond a president and the train is rolling?
You know, we need to do some more shows, because there are not many people in the field that can ask the kinds of questions that you ask. I do a lot of interviews with people. They don't have the knowledge base.
Thank you.
You know the stuff to ask. We need to spend more time. Maybe do a two-hour show or something.
Hey, anytime. You're welcome. I appreciate that.
These are great questions. First of all, yeah, I believe that extraterrestrial presence transcends everything. It transcends politics. It transcends religion, economics. It's the most important issue in the world. Okay, so fine. That still doesn't account for how you're going to get there, right? It transcends. All right. So, again, getting back to the incredibly complicated agenda and tasks that the TTSA faced as it launches, and keeping in mind, remember, I'm certain, you know, I'm dying for them to tell me otherwise, that the plan was to launch the TTSA in November of 2016 and deliver that information to the New York Times, and that article should have been in December 16 of 2016, not 2017, but whatever. So what they were faced with the last election, 2016, was a relatively obvious truth. I don't think it's really debatable, but maybe it is, that the political situation in the United States after 2016 was going to be not only chaotic, it was going to be unstable and chaotic. It was going to be very unusual, and it did not disappoint. I just speaking personal experience, I've lived through quite a few administrations and spent a lot of time in Washington. And I assure you, the last 4 years is unlike anything I've ever seen, period. It's just off the scale. So this idea of a chaotic, unstable situation is not favorable to what they're trying to do. Trying to get hearings in Congress when the Congress is in an endless fight with each other, you know, the two parties locked down, can't get anything done, can't even pass budgets, hating each other, right? Not good. Highly unstable foreign relations issues. And so I think what they saw was, look, this is not conducive. This is a big deal. You know, the hearings on the extraterrestrial issue are going to be massive. They're going to be watched by hundreds of millions of people. And as it evolves and the evidence comes out, it's going to be pretty intense, and there's going to be disclosure. This is a huge deal. This isn't just a treaty with Iran or something like that. It's just not a good idea. And so they slowed down. If you look at their history, they kind of slowed down. Because I assure you, they could have continued to go straight up if they wanted to. They could have delivered stuff to the New York Times every 30 days and do it. They slowed down to see how things were going to go. How is it going to go in 2018 and 19 and what have you? And then they finally started to pick up about mid-year this year. But they did mention that they're sort of standing down until, for a while, they're going to go international, which means they're waiting until next year. And so ultimately, they decided that, look, we need to wait and see what happens in the 2020 election so that we can assess how unstable and chaotic the next 4 years are going to be. And so there were four outcomes to that election as they watched it unfolding. Four outcomes. Trump wins and the GOP holds the Senate. Trump loses and the GOP holds the Senate. Biden wins, GOP holds the Senate. Biden wins and the GOP loses the Senate. And I would humbly suggest that if I were them, I would conclude that with a Biden presidency and a Democratic controlled Senate in which all of the committee chairs are by one party, right? So you can't have a situation where the House wants to hold hearings and the Senate says, screw you. So it's one party. Would be the most stable, non-chaotic, conducive political situation for them to proceed. So at this point, we still don't know. Probably Biden will be president. And the Senate hangs in the balance of two elections in Georgia, January 5. Most never happened before. Two runoff elections, same state for the Senate. Boom, never happened before. So that's going to be fun to watch. I assure you, that's going to be the most intense campaign you'll ever get a chance to watch up close. So we won't know the Senate situation until January the 6th. Fine. We won't have a new president until January 20. So I believe that's what they concluded. Now, we could talk all day long, and maybe one day they'll talk about this. If I get a situation where I'm talking to them or asking them questions, I would say, well, what would you have done if the Republicans had held the Senate and Trump had won? Would you continue to slow walk this thing for 4 months, or would it have been full speed ahead? And so forth. But you know, in a way, those are kind of hypothetical questions, and who needs to go there?
Mm-hmm.
So the long and short of this, and I want to come back and talk in much greater length with you about this and answer your questions. In this, what I'm going to be doing over the next 3 months in my podcasts and in my interviews, and I'm about to crank up and start doing interviews like crazy, at the base level, this. I am convinced at a high level that the goal that they are seeking is at hand, that they have been laying the groundwork, developing the witnesses for congressional hearings, the ones we've been trying to get since 1968 and never could get, even though there have been many attempts. They have the platform, they've done the work. So hearings are going to take place, and they're going to take place early next year. I would say March, early March. And there's reasons why it will be early next year as opposed to, I don't know, 3 years into the next administration. There's some very powerful reasons for that. The witness, I think, are lining up. They've got all they could possibly want. One of their goals in doing what they did and doing the show on history was to lower the bar for witnesses to be able to come on in. And by witnesses, I mean military witnesses. The long stated, I don't know how accurate it was, that they've had 1,500 contacts. I imagine scores of military witnesses have come forward because they have shown them through their activities that you can do that now. Right. David Fravor did that. Nobody's bothering him. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know how many thousands of military witnesses are out there, but it's a lot, either active or retired. And so they're gathering those up, and those will be the people that will testify. And then those hearings will be amongst multiple committees. There are at least six or seven that are totally appropriate. It won't be just one. House and Senate,
mm-hmm.
House Intelligence, Senate Intelligence, House Armed Services, Senate Armed Services. And they got all the witnesses to do that. And it'll go on for weeks. Well, not too long. And the testimony will accumulate in the front of the eyes of hundreds of millions of people around the world under oath testimony, not the citizen hearing on disclosure. Mm-hmm. That was a mock congressional hearing, all right? And as that testimony increases, it will be obvious to the world and the journalists and the committee members that, you know, this testimony pretty much makes it clear that this phenomenon is extraterrestrial. Okay, now it becomes very easy, very comfortable, public relations-wise and other ways, for the president and his aides and the Department of Defense top people and key committee members or party leaders to get together and agree amongst themselves that the evidence is pretty obvious. It's been presented, the people have seen it, it's time to confirm it. And so now the president can go in front of the American people and say something that is public relations-wise exactly what they need. I have been paying attention to these extraordinary hearings. I have heard these witnesses. My staff has analyzed their reports and so forth. And I think it is as clear to me as it is to you that this evidence clearly supports the fact that we are being engaged by non-human intelligent beings from somewhere other than Earth. And so I can confirm that to you today. And people will go, hey, I already knew it, right? But thank you, all right? not anticlimactic, not as dramatic, well received and prepared. That's the way it should be. That's the way it's always been. But how do you get the Congress to do that? I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
Christopher Mellon could, right? Everything they've done has led to him going on the Hill and starting to brief those people up there, either with the pilots or otherwise. We don't even know how many committee chairs he's talked to. It could be dozens. And so we're practically there, John. And so the only thing that's going to stop this, in my view, is something very dramatic happening in around the world.
It could don't be say that. It's 2020. It might happen. Everything else has happened.
So if there's nothing really profound happening, then I believe it will go forward. And so what is my job as a poor political activist with no connections, no non-security disclosure agreement or anything like that, right? What could I do? Here's what I can do. I can do what I did in the last election. I'm going to talk about this for months and months and months and months in order to help ensure they don't change their mind. All right. You just keep putting it out there in front of the people and letting them know this is what you're becoming, so that once the new administration begins and some aides come forward and say, you know, this is tricky. I mean, I don't know. We got a lot on our plate here. And so I tell you what, why don't we put this off? Maybe do it in the, you know, after the midterms in 2023 or whatever. I want to make it as hard as possible for them to go, okay, right? Uh-uh. I don't want to give them a back door. I want them to be, in other words, I want to generate so much media about what I believe is the goal of this organization next year that the idea that they could just, oh, it will hold off, will just not be acceptable. Mm-hmm. Hey, now someone could say, nah, then Steve, you could do that all day long. They don't give a crap what you say or do. They're going to do what they're going to do. That may be true, but I still think it's worth doing. Not to mention the fact it'll educate the public.
Yeah.
I want the public to become more educated about the larger picture so that they can be very clear about how much pressure they're going to put on the committee chairs and the TTSA. Okay, guys, you pretty much got us to the finish line. Cross the end zone, man. Score the damn touchdown. Don't make us sit here for 3 or 4 or 5 more years. We've been waiting for 73 years since Roswell to get this damn thing out. We don't want to wait anymore, not to mention the fact that the world's going to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah.
And so we need something new, exciting. We need some future-looking stuff. We need to know the truth about our world. So let's get it done. So that's going to be my job. And I'm happy to come on your show anytime and pump that out.
Well, you and I have known each other for so long, quite a few years, and I always have a great time talking to you. You were very generous with your time today. I know you're a busy guy. So thank you for coming on here and sharing your side and giving the update on the exopolitical movement. You're welcome anytime. So you definitely, you know, let me know. But honestly, thank you very, very much for joining me and sharing everything with the audience today.
Absolutely, John. Good luck with your podcast. And
appreciate
I look forward to our next encounter, my friend.
Thank you. And thank you all for listening and watching. This is John Greenwald Jr. signing off. We'll see you next time.